All right, back to serious business. Well, on to other serious business. A reminder, I sent out Evites, you all should have gotten it, but I've from the two classes, I've heard back from 29 people, and there's 11 delinquents who haven't answered their Evite. If you can do so today, if you are in that category, I'd rather have you do so and still say maybe rather than not do it, because I'm already overdue on a final definitive count, and I have to. Also, when we did the hand count, there were quite a few people who said they wanted vegetarian, but on the Evite replies, only one person has actually indicated vegetarian. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I couldn't figure out. I left a comment on my response, but I couldn't figure out. I saw one person had vegetarian. I didn't see how are you supposed to mark vegetarian.
Just on the comment. It okay. Should. I read the comments. And,
I know I did, and I think I saw at least one or two others that did.
Oh, so maybe I just misread it. Okay. In any case, I already put in a count. I said there was 35 people coming and 15 vegetarians and 20 non. So I could probably adjust that a little bit. That's what I told them. But I've only gotten 29 replies so far, so I'm below what I'm not worried. I think it'll work out. Okay. So we're going to try today to... we're going to finish up what makes the capital state a capital state and then turn to the problem of the contradictory relationship between the state and capitalism. Obviously a really important set of ideas for the current world we're in. That's, clearly we're in a moment where the state doesn't seem to be doing such a great job in managing to reproduce the conditions for accumulation, which is, after all, from almost every theoretical perspective, one of the central things the state is supposed to do. So that's an important topic. But I'd like to return to and finish off the what makes the capitalist state a capitalist state. I think this is a theme that has very broad ramifications beyond just the narrow, or it's not so narrow, but the specific target of the state. It's basically how to evaluate the character of organizational structures in terms of the effects of those structures. We often think of organizations as ways we get together to do things in the world. A business is an association, a university is an association, an organization. And it's commonplace in ordinary language to complain about things like bureaucracy and red tape, about unfeeling administrators, all the things that we dislike about organizations. When we make those complaints, we're making a comment about their form, about something in the structure that we don't like, which we feel has consequences. Now, in ordinary people's thinking, in the sort of spontaneous thinking about the things we don't like or do like about organizations, we don't generally see these as having a distinctive character. It's just an irritation or an annoyance, right? Few people who complain about red tape ask the question, now what functions does red tape serve for reproducing the social order? It just seems like an irrationality, an idiocy, the result of bad organization or something like that. Well, the what makes the capital state a capital state discussion is basically trying to diagnose all the properties, the formal properties, how things are organized, as a way of getting at the question, do these have distinctive class-relevant effects? Is the character of the form of the state one that we can say, yes, this is a capitalist state or a patriarchal state or a racial state? Not just are the policies pro-capitalist, but is the very form pro-capitalist? Does it have built into its very fabric something that we can call a distinctive class character? Now, that's a pretty elusive theoretical problem it's not, you know, a lot of things that sociologists study and social theorists talk about are kind of both common sense and then made more difficult by putting concepts on them. I think I've mentioned this before. There are three great sins of sociology. When my students get their PhDs, I give them my own diploma, which I certify that they are free of the three great sins of sociology. That's the criterion for getting a PhD from me, is that you've proven that you're free of the three great sins. The three great sins of sociology are common sense made difficult, the painful elaboration of the obvious, and bashing down open doors. Right? So those are the three great sins of sociology, and I guarantee that anybody who I'm prepared to give a PhD to has my blessing as having been sinless with respect to those three problems. Well, this is a non-common sense problem. You know, it's a totally not transparent issue. Does the state, in its very form, have a class character? Now, last time we focused on the methodological issue. How would you actually show it? You know, how would you establish the credibility of such claims, the plausibility of them? And I focused on Klaus Offe's, I think, very interesting set of comments around this. That, namely, that in order to diagnose the biases in a structure, what you really have to pay attention to is what is excluded. It's the exclusion mechanisms, he calls them filter mechanisms, or negative selectivity. That's really where the action is. But that's pretty hard to make definitive claims about. You can get, I think, suggestive evidence, you can build a case, you can find comparisons that add credibility to such claims, but it's often pretty hard to convince a skeptic. That's, by the way, this is a little aside from the main thrust here. The way I think you should think about empirical research when you're trying to engage these bigger theoretical problems, as opposed to empirical research that's solving an empirical problem that's just directly posed in some context. The way you should think about empirical evidence is that it adds credibility to arguments. And it invites people to get counter-credibility. So it's always part of dialogue. Evidence is central to the dialogue that adds credibility to one way of looking at things and undermines credibility of other ways. I refer to that as adjudicating alternative positions. That's a softer view than saying that evidence proves theories. You know, there are times when the credibility gets so high and the alternatives get so low that for practical purposes, you can say, yes, it's established. This is, even though all truth in science is provisional, this is so well established in its robust provisionality that it's not a bad approximation to say Darwinian evolution is the way to go. It's broadly established in its broad arguments, and lots of details remain questions of does the evidence add credibility to one side or another. But think of empirical research as part of conversation, as part of dialogue between people who share the view that evidence matters, and evidence comes from observation, and it has to be embedded in argument. That's not privileging inductive or deductive. It's not privileging quantitative or qualitative. It's just saying evidence from the world matters for adding credibility to one way of looking at something over another. That, to me, is the kind of bottom line way to think about this. It's not highfalutin philosophical epistemological, you know, issues. It's just the sort of pragmatist way of thinking about how you push forward. It does imply that there's a cumulative character to knowledge, though, that we know more now than we did in the past about certain problems, as opposed to it's all just perspective, it's all ideology, there is no such thing as scientific knowledge. No, it's not. It's not that kind of postmodernist epistemological relativist position, but it's also not a kind of simple testing hypotheses sort of view. You're adding credibility to arguments. It means, of course, you have to have an argument. That's a lot of problem in social science, is that there isn't a clear argument. And when people say that a piece of work is just descriptive, partially what that really means is it's not clear what the point is. And the expression, what the point is, means how does this descriptive material add to an argument, add credibility to one view in contrast to an alternative? In contrast to an alternative. So for those of you who are either budding or well on your way to being social scientists, get your arguments clear. Make it clear what you're trying to add credibility to. And an essential part of that is to make clear what the alternatives are. So there's alternative ways that the world could work. Sometimes these are battles, because the alternatives are well articulated by contending traditions. More often than not, it's not that clear. But to add credibility to one argument, you have to be able to explain what would be an alternative, which you think the evidence doesn't support. And then you can pursue that through hyper-quantitative statistical significance with nonlinear logistic binomial models or whatever, you know. Or you can do it through ethnographic evidence. To me, that is of way secondary importance to the fact that the evidence has to connect to arguments. All right, my little homily, let's put it aside. So last time we looked at the methodological issues. This time, what I want to do is look at Terborn's effort to actually stick his neck out and say, yes, here are the properties of the state which, when present, render it a capitalist state. Here are properties of the state when present, render it a feudal state. And here are properties of the state when present, render it a socialist state. In each case, the claim is that these properties bring with them specific class content, class effects. He doesn't connect it to Offey's argument, but I think it's very much of a piece. Terborn's argument is that when you have the capitalist form, certain kinds of state actions are excluded. That what's happening with the capitalist form is negative selection. In the simplest formulation, negative selection is a binary. Certain things can happen, certain things can't happen. I think it's probably better to think of this as simply what negative selection does is make certain things harder, less likely. It creates a bias rather than an absolute filter in the sense of an absolute complete exclusion. Some things may be completely excluded, but I think the more general concept is bias, a class bias in the way the state works by virtue of its properties. To bring this back to the very introductory things I said yesterday about the instrumentalist and structuralist perspectives on the state, one way of thinking about this, I mentioned this in the Café Royale this morning, Espresso Royale this morning, in a discussion of these things. One way of thinking about it is this. The instrumentalists will ask the question, who is in the back room pulling the strings, pulling the levers of power? What are the elite groups that are getting together to do it? The structuralist is asking the question, how does that room have to be designed in order for the strings to be pulled in this way, as opposed to in some other way? So the structuralist question need not exclude an importance for people behind the scenes acting in ways that affect policy, but it's rather saying there are many possible rooms behind the scenes. That's the kind of structure in which they can act. And some of these make it awfully easy for bankers and industrial elites and other powerful interests to dictate or shape what the state does, and other possible backrooms would make it awfully hard for them to do it. The claim that the state has a class character is that this is a caricature in a way, but is that the back rooms are designed in a way that facilitates certain kinds of string pulling and makes others harder. The sensible position is that there are both instrumentalist and structuralist aspects of the story. That is, there still are people up behind the scenes pulling the levers, and that does matter. The extreme structuralist view is that the back room is designed in such a way that it doesn't really matter who is in the room acting. They're always going to produce the same kinds of policies. Right, so that's the kind of extreme vision, that the structural properties of the state are so well designed and coherent that they will produce capitalist-affirming and reproductive effects regardless of who captures the levers of power behind the scenes. And the extreme instrumentalist view is it doesn't really matter how the room is designed. Those actors outside of the state are so powerful that the state's going to do what they want anyway. So the extreme instrumentalist says we don't have to worry about the design of the state. The extreme structuralist view says we don't have to worry about who's playing the game behind the scenes. The combined story, which I think is the right way probably to think about it, is that it does matter how it's designed, and therefore how we might redesign it, but it also matters who's actually playing the game, who actually gets into the room. But here we're going to now look at Terborne's account. Now he, I believe, had 11 different elements. You know, he in his master chart of the aspects of the state. I'm going to just focus on a couple of them to illustrate the argument. I have four listed here. This is under Roman numeral 3.2. The selection of tasks, how does the state decide what to do? The nature of resource acquisition, how does the state get the resources it needs to do whatever it is it's going to do? The transformation of tasks, what are the internal procedures of the state which actually produce the implementation of particular policies? And leadership, where does the state get its, how does it recruit the people that are going to be playing the key roles? These are four important elements. Each of these can be organized in different ways. And the question is, can we identify the specific class character of it? So first is the selection of tasks. Here the key issue is, how is the distinction between the public and private spheres institutionalized in the state? How is that contrast constructed, the public versus private? These are constructed in all sorts of ways, in legal procedures, constitutions announce the distinction between public and private, legal rules refine the distinction between public and private. Specific laws define the distinction between public and private. So the demarcation and formalization of this contrast, the public sphere versus the private sphere, is a crucial aspect of how tasks for the state are selected. So the central principle here is that the state legitimately engages in public tasks and leaves alone to others things which are private matters. But what actually makes that demarcation? How should we think about it? And is there a way of defining the contrast public-private that would have a distinctively capitalist character to it? Is there a way of defining the public-private distinction that has a distinctively socialist character? And is there a way that would have a distinctively feudal character? So Terborne's argument here is that any state has to do this. It's not that some states can ignore. They may pretend to ignore the public-private distinction. It may not be part of the vocabulary. But in fact, they are always delimiting some kind of public-private. They have to navigate that somehow or other. The way Terborne describes it is this way. In feudalism, the public is absorbed into the private. that is the private domain of the king. So this is very stylized. You know, it's, of course, it's more complicated in the world. This is just to give the sort of stylized framework within which then the details get elaborated. The king's private realm absorbs the public. The distinction between public and private is embodied in the public being absorbed into the private powers and realm of the king. In capitalism, the two are institutionally distinct, although the boundary shifts over time. There's a clear demarcation between public and private. And in socialism, the private is subordinated to the public. The personal is political would be a feminist expression that captures that idea, that things that go on in the private life are legitimate objects of public deliberation in a socialist framework. Now, that doesn't mean that things that go on in private life are always to be intruded on by the public, but they're just a legitimate, it's a legitimate object of public deliberation, how private lives are taken, are going, and what, how powers within the private sphere of everyday life are being executed. So if you have as a public goal the equalization of power, the minimization of hierarchy, the creation of an egalitarian and democratic world in which all people have equal access to the necessary means to participate effectively in decisions which affect their lives, that means you have to worry about how the personal accumulation of power undermines that egalitarian form of participation. So it becomes a legitimate matter of public concern in this socialist, this way of thinking about socialism. It becomes a legitimate matter to ask the question, what can we do to create a more egalitarian balance of power in the family? Now, it may be that once you subject that to public concern, you say there's little we can do to directly affect that without undermining other values, because we do have other values. We have the value of, you know, of individual autonomy. That's a value. Individual freedom is a value. But it's not a value that's privileged with respect to other values. It's a value that has to be balanced with other values, and that's why it becomes part of public concern. That's different from the capitalist solution to this problem, which says there's a bright line, sharp distinction between the public and the private. We create a barrier, and it's off limits for the state to be involved in certain private matters. But then we can battle about where that barrier is. The battle about that barrier, where that barrier is often hotly contested. When it gets really contested, then it calls into question private property. I mean, part of the reason for creating that barrier is to maintain private property as something off limits for the state to deeply interfere with. So on this first example, Terborn then draws contrasts between all the states we've ever observed in the world, and some which we haven't observed but can imagine. We can imagine a world in which you have states that create a very sharp barrier and make it hard for the state to cross that line between public and private, particularly around property. You know, so that's the case, that's the place where it's sharpest. This, by the way, since we may not have time to discuss the patriarchal state in any detail, this is one of the domains in which one can make the argument that the state has a gendered character. That is, there's another aspect of the public-private demarcation that isn't around property. The property dimension of public-private distinction is the one that capitalism cares about. So the class character of the public-private distinction centers around the nature of property rights and how immune from penetration by the state are they. The gendered aspect of, or the patriarchal aspect of the public-private distinction has to do with the family and how immune gender relations within the family are to state manipulation and intervention. So the patriarchal family, in which that term is itself, it's a contested term within feminism because its literal meaning is rule by the father rather than just male domination. We don't, I think, have to get into that debate here. But the patriarchal family is one in which there's asymmetries of power within the family that are reproduced in all sorts of ways, some of them by virtue of the connection between the family and the economy, but some of them by virtue of the internal relations inside of the family, especially around children, around biological reproduction. So biological reproduction is an essential feature that occurs within families. It's not the only way that reproduction takes place, obviously, but within families, that's a crucial side of this. The sex division around biological reproduction gets transformed into a gender division by virtue of the social relations that exist in the society and the pressures and sanctions that get imposed on people for behaving in particular ways. And then the question is, how insulated that is that from public deliberation and public transformation? The public-private dimension around the family can be organized in such a way as to reinforce male domination or to undermine male domination. And that's what a kind of feminist diagnosis of the public-private distinction would be with respect to the state. Does it give private status to the powers within families in a way that insulates it from the state? Or does it say that, no, it's not a private matter whether men dominate women in the family? The fact that, for example, marital rape is now a crime represents a reduction of the patriarchal character of the state. That is, it used to be that was just off limits, that the definition of the privacy of the family was such that the state felt it was inappropriate. There was a barrier to it intervening in those private matters inside the family. The same with domestic abuse, with violence, well, more generally with violence. The debates that we see now around the problem of the rights of children. Do children have rights, or are really children the property of their parents, in effect, and the parents can do whatever they want, short of killing them, so to speak, or, you know, really violent abuse. Well, the rights of children, the conservatives believe affirming the rights of children is an assault on the family, and the family should be protected from state intervention, and therefore the family barrier is the content of the public-private division around gender issues. And that would be, that's the kind of argument you'd then make around this first dimension, the selection of tasks, if you wanted to say the state has a patriarchal form. So the state has a patriarchal form is not the same as saying that men dominate the state. It's saying that there are aspects of the constitutional rules of the game, of the way legal procedures are set up, on the way the domain of state intervention is defined, which acts by that, just that very distinction, acts to reproduce certain forms of gender relations. Excluding the state from intervention into the hierarchical structures of families, saying that's not on the policy agenda, it's off the table, you can't talk about that stuff in the state. To do that is to reproduce gender relations of a particular form, and therefore is properly described as a patriarchal aspect of the state. And that's the same thing around the public-private distinction. You know, it's an analogy, of course. It's not the same, because what it would mean for the state to intervene in the family is totally different from what it would mean for the state to intervene in private property. That is, the state intervening in private property is a simple matter compared to the state intervening in the family. We can imagine the state intervening in the family in all sorts of ways which we would all find, no matter how egalitarian and deeply a feminist one was, one would find abhorrent. You know, you don't want police forces setting up video cameras in your household to see the extent to which the men are doing their housework on a regular basis. You know, you can imagine this kind of monstrously intrusive policing of homework egalitarianism as a public policy. Well, that my view would be, I wouldn't support such a law that would create police monitoring of housework. But the reason is because it violates other values I hold. Not because I believe that the family is some sacrosanct barrier to state intervention, but because this is a policy that would be an affront to certain values and affirm other values, and on the trade-offs that I would see for that particular thing, it's not worth it. Right? That's different from saying that there's this public-private boundary which is inviolable. You get this kind of point? So this is just an example of how you can think about the form of the state. The public-private boundary thing, I think, is a really interesting one. It has lots of ramifications. And for those of you, you know, who like the more philosophical side of all this, it also, of course, invokes big philosophical issues. The public sphere, what's public, what's private, what do we even mean by private, what's intimate. There's a distinction between intimate relations, personal relations, and private relations. The word private is a claim about boundaries with the state. Personal is a claim, it's a sociological claim about the nature of relations. So we all have interpersonal relations with named persons, people who we are directly, our lives bound up with. But those may or may not be private. They can be part of the public too. You know, other people can observe them, other people can intervene in them. These are separate issues. Okay, that's the first example. You can intervene here, you know, you don't have to just listen to me if you have questions about any of these things. Yeah?
So the idea of like property as an institutional form, like, is that the sense that we're supposed to get, I guess, from the readings that like property is not just material or like it can be conceptualized as both like a concept as well as in terms of the material nature of what property is? Because it seems like while there can be like a distinction between like the class character of the line between private and public talks about the material aspect of property, whereas like the gender character talks about an institutional or like more conceptual concept of property.
Well, the gendered one wasn't about it was public-private, but the content of that distinction wasn't about property.
Well, it's about family. Oh,
family.
So there's a distinction between even like the concept, like family thought about as property.
Private. No, family thought of it. So in the gendered context, the family is the private sphere,
okay. And
it's therefore inviolable. So to call it the private sphere means the state shouldn't intervene in it. Now, there's always exceptions, so even people who defend the private sphere of the family, most of them would regard killing your children as a violation of it's something the state should prevent. So it's not the case that even the extreme familialists, you know, who really regard that as the private sphere, who believe that it's fine for children to have corporal punishment because that's a parental right and the parents should be able to do that. They still would have some exceptions. Just as in capitalism says private property is inviolate. It's the boundary, the barrier. There still is a general acknowledgement. Yes, we have some other values for which some kinds of interventions across that boundary are justified, but they require very, very strong arguments to defend. As opposed to, it's always up for grabs. Does that answer?
I guess so. In terms of like thinking about it in terms of law, right, and codified sets of how relations are supposed to work or whatever in society, like the marital rape case is a good example. Like a lot of feminists would say that before the institution of the marital rape law, like that was a before that institution, it was. Basically a situation where the wife was considered like the property of the husband.
But that's that's just using a metaphor. You know, it's true in the sense that since the property, the language of discussing public and private around property is the iconic language. That's where in the law the notion of private really gets its roots private property. We don't use the expression private family versus public family. You know, we private property is the sort of way we think of it. So it isn't really the case that wives were property of their husbands. They couldn't sell them. You know, I mean, it's just it's a metaphor. It's just an analogy. It was they were treated more like the chattel or the property of their husbands. Most of the aspects of that extreme form of dependency had already been removed prior to the marital rape laws. So it was that there had been a chipping away of the completely private, hermetically, you know, sealed part of the family. That had been chipped away a lot by the 1970s, I guess, when the marital rape laws first appeared, or maybe even later. I wouldn't say it's material versus non-material. There are these different spheres of life, the family being a crucial one, which can be designated off-limits to the state. Private property is another. It's off-limits to the state, and then there are exceptions. Okay. Resource acquisition. That's the another example. In feudalism, state revenues come from the private estates of the king. So the king's revenues come from the king's lands. The king exploits peasants, and the exploitation that's appropriated from those peasants provides the by far the biggest bulk of revenues for the king. In capitalism, state revenues come from taxation of private accumulation. The social surplus is produced through the combined private activities of firms. That surplus is generated in the form of income and profits, and the state then appropriates part of the total social surplus that has been privately produced. So the state has to cross the public-private boundary to acquire its resources, and it's given permission to do so by the people who generate that surplus. In the early forms of the capitalist state, it was notable that that idea that the state crosses the private boundary and takes part of the surplus that's privately produced and therefore needs permission to do so, the implication was that only property owners should vote. Right? So the justification for the property franchise was, well, the property owners are the people who are paying the taxes because it's their property, you know, that's generating the surplus, and therefore they need to give permission for it to be used. So the property-based franchise is very deeply connected to taxation. After all, that's the slogan of the American Revolution, right? No taxation without representation. But representation of who? Not the people, but of the surplus producers, which were thought of as the property owners. So that's a really kind of interesting feature of the no taxation without representation. That you need permission. And it's a common sense thing, you know. It seems if you're going to take my money, you need my permission. Well, I give you my permission because we have common purposes for which you, the state, can do it better than I can, but you still need my permission. But who do you ask permission for? Well, it's the people who generated the income. That's a non-democratic view of why we need democracy, right? It's an anti-democratic theory of democracy. We need the consent of the governed because we need the consent of the taxpayer, not of the citizen. It was only the result of struggles and of social conflicts that there was an additional then rationale for extending democracy. We need to extend democracy because we have a legitimation problem if we have a lot of people who are being subjected to laws, not just taxation, to which they did not provide prior consent because they weren't voters. And then it took until the 1960s before that was fully generalized in the United States to include African Americans and other minorities who were disenfranchised in various formal and informal ways. And even today, you know, the United States is pretty pitiful with respect to the robustness of its view of citizen rights with respect to consent to be governed. But because of the disenfranchisement rules around felons, which is probably the most notorious example. But as we know from the recent efforts to disenfranchise, by making it hard, you know, disenfranchisement can be simply making it really hard for people to vote. That's occurring now through the various efforts to increase burdens of voting. So taxation in capitalism has this very peculiar structure. The state needs revenues to do whatever it's going to do. So all the public goods that the state might want to do, to produce, which can be expansive or restricted. You can have an expansive view, even in a capitalist society, of what the public goods should be. We should have a vibrant arts and culture sector, which requires substantial public subsidies in order to work, because markets simply will not produce widespread and diverse culture. So we need arts programs of various sorts. We need national parks and recreational facilities, because markets will not produce them in the right kind of way. There's all these public goods we might want to produce in a world where we still say yes and let everything be produced, you know, for the everything that individuals privately consume, let's let markets do that. So you could have that view. But then in order to fund the public goods, you have to tax the private surplus, the privately produced surplus. That creates a particular structure of dependency of the state on the vibrant conditions for the production of the private surplus. So the way the state gets, if the state only gets its revenues through taxation, that's a structural feature of the state. Once that's in place, it means that all sorts of things have to be paid attention to and other things given lower priority to because of that dependency relationship. In a socialist state, the state gets its revenues from public enterprises. So the whole surplus is under the budgetary authority of the state, and then it simply has to face the question, well, how do we want to allocate it? So there's all sorts of purposes that the collective would have. We may want some growth. We may want certain sectors to expand. We may want others to contract. We may want more parks. We may want smaller classrooms. There's just all these different priorities on how you can use the available resources. You have a total social production. It produces a social surplus. How should we allocate it? That whole surplus is up for grabs to be allocated for one purpose or another. It's not that it's privately produced, and then the state has to siphon some of it off. That would be the socialist model for how resources are acquired by the state. Now, the key idea here for the purposes of capitalism, the key idea here is that the capitalist form of the state makes the state dependent on its tax base for revenue. The state is forced to avoid policies which undermine its tax base. This constraint, however, should be thought of as a variable constraint. So it is a constraint. All capitalist states are dependent on their tax base. But it's a variable constraint. There are different ways you can organize how you get your taxes, which will either intensify this constraint or weaken the constraint. So just think on the very simplest level. How are taxes paid? What's the mechanics of it? Well, one kind of tax system is what are called value-added taxes. That's the way it's done in most European countries. We don't really have value-added taxes. We have sales taxes. Now, the thing about value-added taxes is that they're invisible. You don't know what the taxes are. You buy something and you don't know what part of the cost is taxes. Sales taxes are transparent. There's unequivocal evidence that value taxes generate more revenues than sales taxes, because the non-transparency means that people just fold it into the price of things. The degree of centralization of tax systems. So in the United States, we have 50 states, each with a separate tax system. The tax rates across states vary enormously in the U.S. They vary proportionately across the U.S. Tax rates across states vary proportionately more than tax rates across European countries vary. They're not as high, you know, tax rates, but you know, my brother lives in Texas. He pays no income tax, and he pays property taxes that are about a fifth what I pay. His sales taxes are a bit higher, but overall, I pay, you know, probably on roughly the same income, probably four times the taxes that he pays in Texas. So, you know, tax rates vary enormously across the U.S. What the tax system, European systems are very centralized, the United States is very decentralized. There's some interesting examples in the contemporary world of tax systems which are not capitalist in character. That is, the revenues of the state don't come from taxing private surplus. So the Saudi and Bahraini governments get their tax, they get their revenues directly from their ownership of oil. That's why in Bahrain the per capita income of people includes, if you're unemployed, the state gives you $40,000 a year if you're a Bahraini citizen. You know, you get this kind of guaranteed basic income that's very high if you're a citizen. It's just simply using oil revenues, which are directly state revenues. Norway is an interesting case because Norway has huge oil reserves which remain owned by the state. It's Statoil which exploits the oil. The refineries are private, but the oil is extracted through a state enterprise. And Norway, however, remains a capitalist state. What it's done is it's insulated the state budget from the oil revenues. So the oil revenues cannot be just simply flow into the state budget. They are used for very specific targeted purposes and are kind of treated as if they were private revenues, even though it's state-owned. And it's an interesting case about how the state insulates itself from the temptation. It's a kind of Ulysses and the Sirens problem, from the temptation of being freed from the constraints of accumulation, so that the taxes that run the Norwegian state are ordinary value-added taxes and income taxes and property taxes like every other state, not revenues generated by the oil industry. The oil industry does provide some source of revenues, but the oil industry profits get invested in sovereign wealth funds, and the interest from the sovereign wealth funds can go into the general coffers of the state, but not the revenues themselves. And that's an important distinction in terms of whether the state remains dependent on accumulation or not. All right.
So, Eric, why, apart from the oil example, why would the specific way you collect taxes, either value added or sales tax, why would that change the capitalist or the class nature of the state?
No, it doesn't change. It just changes how constraining is the fact the state remains dependent on privately generated surplus. But then the question still remains, what proportion of that privately generated surplus is available to the state? The state is dependent on it. In Sweden, the state taxes about 40% of GDP. In the U.S., it's about 25% of GDP. So that's a pretty big spread. We're at the low end, about 25% of the gross domestic product is taxed. In Sweden, it's 45%. So that's a 20% spread. So in developed capitalist countries, that's the limits of possibility. Why is it 45% in Sweden and 25% here? There's lots of reasons for that, but among those reasons are the way taxes are gathered.
But it doesn't really matter what the tax rate is as much as how much of their budget, what percentage of their budget depends on taxes, which is probably the same, isn't it? I mean, no matter what, if you
Well, the difference there, there is this added complication, which is you can borrow. You can borrow rather than pay for things out of taxes, so you can increase your national debt. The U.S. is in a privileged position to be able to do that because of our role in the global system. So that's an added complication. Borrowing is essentially borrowing against future taxes. So it's still ultimately bound up with tax dependency, but in this more elusive way, with more risk and uncertainty involved, and as we see, of course, in some of the crisis context today. Lachelle.
Couldn't it be argued, though, that the way a society's taxed does have something to do with the class character? Because, for example, when you're talking about Texas, it depends a lot on progressive taxes. That could really sort of exaggerate class distinction. Because if somebody who has an income, like your brother, is not paying income taxes and property taxes, it's going to give them a pretty strong advantage over people who are paying the same sales tax.
Yeah. So there's some really interesting sociological as well as economic issues around taxation. I think it's a topic that sociologists have not paid enough attention to, the sociology of taxation. It's why in the other book I published last year, American Society, How It Really Works, we have a whole chapter on taxation. When I teach my undergraduate course, I give a chapter on taxation because I think it really is important. A lot of the variation in tax structures do not determine how much of the total social surplus goes into taxes, but among wage earners, who's paying it and who's not. So it's more about the redistribution of tax burden among the wage-earning part of the population. The striking thing about Sweden is they have lower corporate income taxes than the U.S. They don't tax corporations. They just tax the hell out of everybody's income. And then use it for redistributive purposes. So in principle, in a capitalist society, the wage earning, sort of 70% of the total gross national product goes into, or 65% goes to wage earners. People could say, yes, we want public goods. We're all prepared to reduce our private standard of living by giving up our privately earned income in the form of taxes so that our public standard of living, our social wage, is higher. So you could redistribute from private consumption to public consumption among wage earners and leave profits alone. So you could have a deal which says, yeah, we want to keep profits as high as possible. We don't want to tax it because that's where accumulation comes from. That's where growth comes from, where jobs come from. But we're prepared to have very heavy taxes on wages to be used to produce public goods. That would be could be a stable compromise. That's pretty much the way one would describe Sweden, I think, is that the amount of surplus available to Swedish capitalists is not squeezed by the tax system. What's squeezed is high earners. They pay very high taxes in Sweden. So they have less money available for high private consumption in exchange for high public consumption, public goods. So in Texas, what you have then is a situation where it's not just that they're not squeezing capitalists, they're not squeezing high earners, and they're, in fact, lowering the standard of living of ordinary wage earners. Texas is, if you look across the U.S., there are a few states in which the income distribution is worse after taxes than before taxes. That's not true in most places. In most places in the U.S., inequality among wage earners is lower after taxes and after transfers. So if you look at inequalities of standard of living before taxes and transfers, and then after taxes and transfers, in the United States as a whole, inequality is reduced by about 18% through the tax and transfer system. In Sweden, it's reduced by about 50% through the tax and transfer system. In Alabama, inequality is increased by the tax and transfer system. So the situation is actually worse after the state gets into the act, not better. There's only a couple. Texas isn't in that category. Texas doesn't actually make the condition overall of inequality worse by its tax and transfer system. It just doesn't improve it. Yeah.
What are some of the reasons for that, for how taxation can actually increase inequality in some places and not others?
I assume the basic explanation is just the balance of power of social forces. You know, that's a kind of glib answer, but you know, the dominance of very right-wing political forces in Mississippi and Alabama, and they're not being balanced by any other kind of business interest. So, you know, businesses are interested in certain kinds of public education and a certain kind of labor force, which then acts as a counterforce to the most extreme positions. I assume that that's what's going on in Mississippi and Alabama, bound up with the historic racism of its system of inequality. So if the poor are black disproportionately, and there's a very weak sense of solidarity with their fate, that would further undermine any redistributive kind of component to the tax and transfer system. Let me just quickly mention the other two components that I have listed on the outline, just as examples. So the transformation of tasks. Here the contrast centers around the nature of the Weberian type bureaucracy. So the Weberian type bureaucracy is a particular way of organizing the administrative procedures for executing policies. So the Weberian type bureaucracy has as its formal structure an administrative hierarchy with a head at the top that issues orders that work their way down, and the bureaucrats at the bottom execute those orders faithfully as incumbents of an office where they subscribe to particular rules. And the policy process works from the top down. It doesn't imply that there isn't there aren't experts who are thoughtfully figuring out the costs and benefits of different implementation rules. It doesn't imply that this is arbitrary. It can be sensible or not, depending upon other details. But the key idea is that it's top-down, a kind of command and control form of administration. Now, there's a contrast. There's other ways of organizing administrations. You can have citizen boards. You can have deliberative administrative institutions with citizen participation. You can have budgets organized through participatory budgeting rather than mayor's bureaucratic planning offices. Right? There's lots of ways in which popular democratic participation in the actual formation of the implementation rules can take place. That would be the contrast between a capitalist form of the administration of the state. So using the term bureaucracy in the distinctively Weberian sense, Terborn would argue that bureaucracy is a capitalist form of administration, and various kinds of participatory administrative procedures, of which we can think of a lot, would constitute a socialist form of administration. The key issue is that in the Weberian bureaucracy, the implementation of rules is insulated from popular pressure. Popular pressure is excluded from involvement in the implementation rules, whereas in these other participatory forms, citizen input in varying ways and in various forms becomes crucial for the actual elaboration of how the state will function. That's the transformation of tasks. So we could define a distinctive class bias in the character, the means by which the rules get refined and implemented. So remember, this is part of the view that the way in which a democratic assembly passes a law, the Environmental Protection Agency or this Endangered Species Act, gets passed by Congress, it then has to be implemented by a bureaucracy. And there are many implementation rules that are all consistent with the basic law. How are those implementation rules done? And how do they work their way down to the ground? And that can be a non-participatory process, or that's insulated from the public or not. And the socialist form of administration would have all sorts of ways for participation and democratic accountability in the implementation process, of which there's not a single design, any more than there's a single design for parliaments. There's many ways you can do it. And the capitalist way of doing it is to ensure that it's insulated from pressure, popular pressure. Finally, leadership, just to wrap up this part of the story. In feudalism, the state personnel take the form of personal dependence on the lord or the king. So it's personal dependency in which you owe your position to the person above and you owe your loyalty to that person. Fealty is the term that's used in the feudal case. A personal dependency is the central way in which the actual personnel, the leadership personnel of the state is acquired. Sometimes that's called patrimonialism too, but it's basically personal dependency, I think, is the way to think about it. In capitalism, it's professional, bureaucratic, meritocratic recruitment through a depersonalized form. You don't owe your office as a personal favor to the person above you. You don't owe them loyalty. You owe loyalty to the institution, not to the person on the recruitment panel that hired you. Yeah.
No. So with these two, like the transformation of tasks in particular, Terborn mentions that it is that related to what he calls organizational technology.
Yeah.
So he describes in the book that it's not, or in the essay that it's not a part of the actual input transformation output process. That it's somehow that organizational technology is inherent to the system. He compares it to a productive force, and I was a little confused over that.
I don't remember that specific part of the argument. Okay. So it may not.
I'm bringing up, yeah.
Yeah. So I'd have to reread that particular piece to see if my initial answer to your question, which was yes, it is part of that organizational technology, if that was right, because it may not be. So professional bureaucratic recruitment would be the distinctively capitalist way of filling up, getting people into the positions. In socialism, it's what Terborn calls cadre leadership, or if you were British, cater leadership. Cadre leadership. This is meant to describe the recruitment of people into bureaucracies who have organic connections to the communities that those bureaucracies serve. So it would be environmental activists would be in a privileged position to become part of the EPA administrative apparatus because they would be best positioned to be deeply engaged in the participatory environment under which proper implementation of environmental rules would take place through democratic accountability by drawing the leadership from people who are actively involved organically in the communities of concern around those issues. It's his particular descriptions of this were a little bit idealized and bound up with a sort of Communist Party mythology about the way political leaders emerge organically from working class communities. But I think the principle is still reasonable, that the leadership of organizations are drawn from the communities that are most concerned and involved in those issues, which will include people who are trained professionals, who are also activists, but activists not in the sense of the troublemakers who are disrupting the system. That may be the case, but that's not the main point. Activists in the sense of very active in the popular associational life around the issues for which that administrative body has concern. And that would be what could be called cadre leadership as opposed to purely bureaucratic, meritocratic. In the extreme form, in the kind of communist context, this was often described as the red versus expert problem, recruiting bureaucrats who were reds rather than experts. That was a kind of caricature of this idea. The idea here is that you want people who are on the ground connected to the communities of concern around whatever it is you're trying to have state administration. So that there's an organic connection between administration and popular forces rather than an insulated relationship. I think we have to stop the what makes the capitalist state a capitalist state. And then after the break, turn to the issue of the capitalist state and accumulation, which will undoubtedly take us into Wednesday as well.